This week on Two Legs, the Queen is here.
That's right, and she's here to discuss the Mac and Jack story, so...
Guys, why aren't you bowing?
sorry. Hi, McCartney fans, and welcome to another edition of Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast. We are a Paul McCartney talk show mainly dealing with the Paul solo career. I'm one of your two co-hosts, Tom Hunyadi, and you may know me from my other show, Talk More Talk, a solo Beatles videocast. And as always, I'm joined by my co-host and partner in crime, Andy Nichols. Andy, what's going on?
Afternoon, Thomas. How are you?
I'm doing great. How's your week been going?
It's been fantastic. Just getting over this flu, and I think most of it's finally gone and out of my system.
I'm happy to hear that. Great. Well, today on the show, it's all about Mac and Jack. And I'm proud to say I think we got the perfect person for the show. She's my co-host on Talk More Talk, and it's great to see her. She is the author of this guy right here, Songs We Were Singing, guided tours through the Beatles' lesser-known tracks, and also this guy right here, Michael Jackson FAQ, All That's Left to Know About the King of Pop. And this book really came in handy for this week's show. So thank you, Kit, for the book, and really good read so far. I'm really enjoying it. So a lot of great information. So hello and welcome back to the show.
Oh, great to be back, as always, with you, Tom. And Andy, finally good to see you and talk to you.
Yes, albeit virtually, but yes, Kit, absolutely.
Yes.
Right.
Until the fest.
Until the fest, that's right.
Well, we all know her as the queen of all Beatles media, and she's getting more and more nicknames as time goes by. I mean, we got the quick queen of lipstick, we got the queen of nail polish, and it's just growing and growing. So Kit, thank you for coming back to the show. We're really happy to have you here. And first, our last couple shows, we've had a great time talking with Alan Cozen and Robert Regas about this new Let It Be release that's coming up. We still don't have a lot of details on it yet and what's going to be involved, what's going to be on the project. So I would love to just to hear your take on it. You know, what would you like to see on the set itself? And take it away.
Well, I mean, obviously, I would love to see, first off, a remastered version of the original version. I mean, yes, the Phil Spector version. Would like to actually see the Let It Be Naked version included in the set. Okay. Even though it wasn't, when it came out, it wasn't quite the revelation that I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be so much better than the Phil Spector version. And when I heard it, I thought some of it was, some of it was, but some of it I thought, that really didn't make as much of a difference as I expected, but right. It's good to have. So I would like to see that included. Obviously would love to see, hear a lot of the outtakes. However, they would need to be edited, very carefully.
Right.
I don't need to hear every single utterance. I mean, there's like a 90-volume set out there 80, or something?
86 CDs, yes.
Yeah. And hey, we're all big fans here. We know that. But I don't know about you.
But I'm not listening to it.
You know, it's funny because, David, my cousin, who, started the show with, ex-co-host, he bought that set, and then he made me copies of it and sent it to me, and so he said by copying the 50th disc, he about had it. It's like,
God bless him.
But I tell you though, he sent me the set, and by the time I got to finished with the third disc, I was like, I'm ready for a break.
Very tedious listening, that set, I gotta tell you.
I mean, really.
However, there's some very interesting sound bites in there, though.
Absolutely. So as long as they're edited down, to just the, interesting stuff.
Yeah.
That's great. That's all we need. Obviously, would love to see, an extensive book in there, although I guess we are going to get a book.
Yes.
Later this year. But I would assume that in the set we're going to get another one. And hopefully a good description and really taking us inside those sessions. I'm not looking for a whitewashed version of the sessions. I mean, I definitely want a fair assessment of them. What really happened? I don't need to have them be glossed over, just as accurate as possible. And I know this is, they're all in, Paul and Ringo and all of them are involved in it, so I don't know how accurate it's going to be, so to speak, but I'd like it to be. Wouldn't mind also the original, the booklet that came with it that fell apart.
Yeah.
I'd like to see a reproduction of that.
That would
obviously
be really
better
cool.
Put together.
Yeah.
Right. Yes, I think that could happen.
Yeah, would really like to see that.
Put it together as well as that Beatles single set was put together, right?
Right. Yeah, if they could do that, that was first class. If they could do something like that, that would be perfect.
It's funny you mentioned the book, kid. Over the summer, I scored a copy of the Let It Be box, the original pressing from the UK with the book.
Oh, cool.
And it's the book is in decent shape, but the binding is just not there. If they could reproduce a facsimile, like you mentioned, of the book in this new set, that would be tremendous. Just exactly the same way. Don't doctor it. Just give us that original book.
Yep, exactly. But with a better binding.
Correct.
So my demands are relatively few, but those are the main things. And of course, looking forward to the Peter Jackson documentary, and I'm glad that the original one will still be released. I was worried for a while that was going to replace it, but no, it isn't. So, because again, we don't want to rewrite history I just think it's important to present all sides here.
Right. I think so too. I agree with you 100% there. I think a lot of us were worried that original Let It Be movie would not be released, and they have said that it will get released. So I think that's really important. Michael Lindsay Hogg has said it, that it's been ready since the Let It Be Naked film has come out. It's been remastered and some film restoration done on the film. So I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing if that comes true.
I mean, we're talking almost 20 years since almost 20 years since Let It Be Naked. So they've been sitting on this for quite a while.
Yeah, and it's interesting though. You talk to people at Fest. I think it was a couple of years ago. I heard someone saying this, that there was talk again of when will Let It Be come out? And somebody said, I don't want to see it. It's too depressing. Well, I mean, yes, it's not like watching, Hard Day's Night or something.
Right.
But it's part of history. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's not fun watching Paul and George argue, but I mean, that's what happened. That's part of the creative process. I mean, you're watching, the breakup of the band.
Yeah. I mean, where else are you going to see, Mel Evans bang on the anvil during Maxwell's Silver Hammer,
exactly.
I mean, I can almost think of it as a Magical Mystery Tour. I mean, the movie as a whole is not necessarily considered a masterpiece or even great by that means. But where else are you going to see, footage of the rooftop, or or, you know, the, you know, great versions of the two of us, or, you know, Let It Be, you know, and stuff like that. You know, I mean, it's
right.
I mean, it's great for that.
Yeah, you know? It's a historical document as far as I'm concerned. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. So, as I stated, it's all about the Mac and Jack. Today we're going to be talking about Paul McCartney and Michael Jackson's collaborative relationship. And, you know, this book came into play. It's your Michael Jackson FAQ. I want to talk about this for a second, Kid, if you don't mind. Talk about, you know, getting involved in this book, writing it. You know, how did it come to be?
Well, it actually started, I used to write for a site called Blog Critics, and when Michael Jackson passed, I wrote a piece, actually wrote a couple of pieces, one of them assessing his work, you know, talking about what, you know, songs that I thought were underrated of his, but I also wrote a piece about the Motown 25 performance when he debuted the Moonwalk.
Right.
And yep, and I talked about how I felt like it was sort of my generation, like as close as we got to like the Beatles and Ed Sullivan, because I remember the morning after that performance going to school and all of us on the playground were trying to figure out how we did the Moonwalk. Like everybody was talking about that. I mean, it was like one of those water cooler moment, you know, kind of things. So I wrote this piece. So you mentioned Robert Rodriguez at the beginning of the show. Right. Well, he contacted me shortly after that ran and said Backbeat Books, the publisher, who they've been doing this FAQ series, which Robert actually helped devise.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, he came up with the idea. He said they're looking for somebody to write a Michael Jackson, you know, FAQ, and you know, I think you would be perfect for this. And I said, as long as I can focus on the art, you know, his art, his music, I'm not interested in any sensational stuff. You know, there's been enough of that garbage written.
Well, that's one of the great things about it is just focus on the positive, you know, focus about the man's work. I mean, I don't even think you wrote about him buying ATV in the book.
No, because again, you know, I mean, I may have vaguely referred to it at one point, but again, I just thought that's not what this is about. I wanted this to be, you know, a guide for fans, for people who are interested in learning more about his work. You know, if you want to read about that stuff, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, trashy stuff out there, but there are a couple of decent biographies out there of them where you can read you know, things where it goes into a little more detail about that. But I mean, to me, it was like, hey, I wasn't there. I don't know. You know, I also, I didn't want to attract the attention of the family, to be honest with you. You know, and so I'm like, that's what I'm interested in, his music, his dance, his impact on culture. And so that's what my book is about. I'm hoping that when people read it, that, you know, one of the things I have in it is I have playlists where, you know, I thought about, okay, if I were to explain, you know, describe Michael Jackson to somebody who had never heard his stuff, you know, what are the kind of songs I'd recommend for you know, them to start with. And I'm hoping that people will read the book and say, well, why did she leave out XYZ? You know, great. I want this book to stimulate conversations like that. And, you know, because as we know from our Beatlefest and all, you know, we live for conversations like that. Well, that's what I'm hoping this will inspire.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, like I said, it's you know, everything that I've read so far in the book, I mean, it's very informative and very well written. So, you know, great job. And I look forward to, you know, reading more of the Michael Jackson FAQ. It's a pretty interesting series. You know, I've got a couple other ones, you know, obviously the solo, you know, or the Fab Four, the, you know, Fab Four FAQ one two. I got the, you know, a Kiss, Neil Young, and a Doctor Who one. You know, so it's you know, pretty good series. You know, so looking at a couple other ones to pick up as well. So yeah.
What I like, you know, about them is that you don't have to read them cover to cover. You know, I mean, you can pick them up and just, if you want to read about a particular album or a particular time. I mean, it's really great for that. I mean, you can just read it at your leisure and also you can have a little fun with it. You know, I tried to do that, like in one chapter where I, you know, instead of just writing a straightforward, okay, here's one chapter about Off the Wall, here's another one about Thriller. You know, so many people have said to me when I've mentioned that I've written this book, they'll say, which album do you really think is better? So I thought, okay, I'm going to do like the ultimate, you know, in the book, I'm going to do like the ultimate throwdown, Off the Wall versus Thriller, you know. And so I tried to have a little fun with it, you know, things like that. And this FAQ format lets you do that. So it was a lot of fun.
So which one is better?
You know, in the book, I sort of come out that they're even, but sentimentally, Off the Wall.
See, I would have thought you would have picked Thriller.
No, because Off the Wall, I actually bought, that was one of my earliest albums that I ever bought. So, you know, so it's, I grew up with it.
Very cool. Well, let's get started here talking about, you know, Michael and Paul, because, you know, they kind of, starting in 1970, they kind of started having this little, you know, rivalry with the Beatles and the Jackson 5. And, you know, we were just talking about the one, but then you found another one, too, that we're going to talk about here, another song here. But, you know, right off the bat, in 1970, the Jackson 5, they knock Let It Be off the top spot with ABC.
That's right. Yep. On April 25th, 1970, they knock up Let It Be, and then they do it again just a few months later. On June 27th, they knock off Long and Winding Road with The Love You Save. So they do it not once but twice. So that's kind of, you consider that kind of their first encounter, in a way, and sort of a, you know, maybe a little signaling of a changing of the guard, not in terms of, I mean, their music wasn't quite the same, but in terms of, you know, teenage fandom, you know, was a little bit of a passing of the, you know, passing on of the torch in a way to a new kind of teen mania.
Do you know if the Jacksons, did they ever cover a Beatles song?
Yes, they did. Because I looked into that. I was curious, and they did cover Let It Be.
That's the one I thought. That's what I thought. Okay.
Yep, they did. Particularly on, you know, like many acts of the 70s, they did the variety show.
Right.
You know, everybody, I mean, your parents probably had a variety show at one point in the 70s. Everybody had a variety show. And so they guested on Jim Nabors had one at one point.
Wow.
They did a version of Let It Be, an a cappella version, which was kind of cool. And they did it again on The Tonight Show. And then they were on American Bandstand. Now, they didn't cover Beatles song, but Michael was interviewed, and Dick Clark asked him, who are some of your favorite artists? And he mentioned the Beatles.
Oh.
So, you know, so yeah, so there were a little, you know.
So there was an admiration there for the Beatles by the Jacksons.
Absolutely.
Michael Jackson in particular.
Oh, definitely. Yes, they definitely knew who they were. Absolutely.
Gotcha. I'd have to say that they were probably thrilled to, you know, not once but twice knock them off the top spot. I mean, you'd have to say that, you know, those were some happy times for sure.
No,
because not soon after, I mean, Michael starts his solo career. What I would say in what, 71 was it, the following year he starts a solo career?
And really kicked it off in 72 with Ben.
I said Ben was his first one, right?
Yep, that was his biggest. You know, that really, and unfortunately, I mean, yes, that started him off. And Rockin' Robin, his cover of Rockin' Robin was another.
I think it was a top three hit.
Yep, yeah. Exactly. Unfortunately, Motown, as he grew older, as of course it's going to happen, Motown just didn't know what to do with him. And he recorded a few more solo albums, and they just didn't do much.
Yeah.
Ben did fine.
Right.
But the other two, there was one, Forever Michael, it was just cringeworthy. Really songs that they were trying to sort of make him into a teen idol, but it just was awkward. And, the material just wasn't there. And, remember, Motown, with the exception of maybe Marvin Gaye and Stevie Wonder, they didn't really encourage their artists to write their own stuff. Marvin Gaye and Stevie Wonder had to fight for that. Michael talked about in later interviews, he had to, they would constantly, he and his brother say, we'd like to start writing some of our own stuff, and Berry Gordy would turn them down every time.
Gotcha.
So they were, and that's one of the reasons, one of the main reasons they left Motown, because, the material was just drying up. So Michael was... had some early solo success, but by the, by 74 or so.
75,
74, 75, it was starting to wane.
Yeah, because you can tell just by the performances of his last two solo records on Motown, one went to 92 and the other one was at 101, unfortunately. So, as you say, the audience for those records just weren't there. And, Motown, as you say, didn't know how to, handle, Jackson's solo career. So right now we're gonna kind of like discuss, Michael Jackson pre 1980, before he makes that famous phone call to Paul. So as you say, 75, then comes the move to Epic, where Michael and the Jacksons, which are no longer, they dropped the five, they're just the Jacksons now. Mm-hmm. And now they made the move to Epic, but they don't really, he doesn't release anything until 79, I don't think, but the Jacksons themselves, they're releasing material right off the bat.
Yeah, they start out, well, first of all, Jermaine Jackson, by this time, he elected to stay with Motown. So,
oh, wow, okay.
He elected to stay, and so Randy Jackson joins the group, the youngest. He sort of replaces Jermaine. And the reason they had to change their name, by the way, was that Berry Gordy essentially said to them, I own that name.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
And so, so they had to change it. And so, think about it. So they had to basically start over. Mm-hmm. They weren't the cute little kids anymore. And they had to, refashion their image. So they go to Epic. And the first couple of albums they record are under Gamble and Huff. The legendary Philly soul producers.
Right.
The first one was I thought was underrated. It was just called The Jacksons, and its biggest hit was "Enjoy Yourself." If you remember that song, and it was a lot of fun. It had some nice, and it was very Philly soul influence. And then they did another one, which really didn't go anywhere. And then the Jacksons started saying, "We want to start producing our own stuff. We want to start writing our own stuff." And right around that time, disco was happening,
right?
Yeah.
And so the two collided,
right?
And so then they started doing stuff like "Blame It on the Boogie," "Shake Your Body Down to the Ground," and they start going up again. They start becoming relevant again. And it's around this time that Michael's starting to write some of his own stuff,
right?
More and more, including "Shake Your Body Down to the Ground." Yeah,
right. And it's also right about this time where he signed on to do The Wiz, the movie with Diana Ross, kind of like a Wizard of Oz remake. If no one's seen it out there, it's interesting for sure. I don't think it's a terrible movie. I kind of enjoyed it when I was a kid. I had watched it some years back, and I was just shaking my head a lot rewatching it, because unfortunately I just don't think it had the same impact on me as an adult as it did as a kid. But this is where he meets Quincy Jones, and by this time Quincy has really made a name for himself. There's a great documentary, I think it's on Netflix right now, on Quincy Jones, where he just talks about, you know, a lot of his struggles, you know, becoming a musician and a writer, and then a producer, and doing all these great film scores, and then now here he is, you know, getting ready to meet somebody that's just going to take him to the next level, pretty much.
Yeah, and you know? And by the way, you know, now we think of them, of course, as, you know, this big team. But when Quincy offered to produce Michael's next album, some people thought Michael was nuts to go with him, because at the time he wasn't really known as a sort of pop R&B producer. I mean, he was jazz.
Yes, exactly, right.
Yeah. You know, and he had done some R&B, but you know, wasn't primarily known for that. And so, you know, the people, as I said, thought he was crazy to do it. So, you know, nobody foresaw that was going to become the partnership that it was.
And just to clarify, you know, because he made those controversial comments about, you know, Beatles as bad musicians, I mean, you got to remember, though, as a musician working in jazz and whatnot, he has worked with some of the greatest musicians of all time, you know, musicians that know how to, you know, read and write music. So, I mean, I can kind of understand a little bit his side of it,
those
comments. But still, it's something, a comment that probably should have never been made to begin with.
Yeah, I think I read that Quincy's kids got a hold of him and said, don't give any more interviews.
Or if you do, just make sure you just rephrase what you say differently or something.
Right.
Yeah, I already apologized. He called Paul and apologized.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's a little bit older. And, you know, so.
Yeah, that's funny. But before the release of Off the Wall, Michael does this BBC radio show with George Harrison.
Yes, and the whole recording surfaced after the publication of my book, so it's really not in there. So, yeah, of course, this came out after my book came out.
Well, part two, then.
So, yeah, this will be in part two. on February 9th, 1979, George Harrison and Michael Jackson did this program together. It was a BBC show called Roundtable. And it was hosted by David Kidd Jensen, and it was this show where apparently they would bring on artists and would interview them about whatever, you know, they were promoting at the time, but also would ask them to rate new records. Like, they would play these new records and then say to the artist, what do you think of these?
Right.
And so it's fascinating to listen to. The whole thing is online now, and there used to be just a section of it, and it was really bad quality, and somebody finally restored it, and now it's much better. It's fascinating. George is promoting George Harrison.
Okay.
He's talking about that. Michael is kind of in between projects. I think he's talking about Destiny, which is the album that the world smash hit album he had done with the Jacksons. He is just a few months away from releasing Off the Wall. So he's sort of referring to it, but not talking about it vividly at that point. And Michael seems pretty intimidated. You know, you can tell he's a little nervous in the interview. And George is really, you know, what you would expect when they they play singles by, it was Eddie Money, Nicolette Larson, Van Morrison, Dave Edmonds, Cat Stevens, Manfred Mann, and Foreigner.
Okay.
And, you know, Michael tends to say, you know, they'll say, what do you think? And Michael will just be like, that's nice. You know, I like the nice beat. And, you know, George would be like, I like the original version better.
Oh, honest George.
He was honest. And one of the more interesting exchanges is when, George talks about being in the Beatles and how it was, you know, how hard it was to get heard with, you know, John and Paul, him being such a force. And Michael sort of asks him about that and said, wow, you know, how did you get your own stuff in there? And George said it wasn't easy. And then later on, George starts talking about something, and he said something, when I wrote something, and mm-hmm. Michael said, wait a minute, you wrote that? I thought that was John and Paul. And George said, yeah, everybody thinks that.
Yeah, he wasn't the only one, was he?
No, he wasn't. So, I mean, it was just funny that here, of course, some years later, he would own the catalog, but back then he didn't even know George wrote something. I mean, it was really surreal, I mean, right. listening to it. So, yeah, so they had this encounter, but George said very nice things, you know. I mean, at one point said he liked the production on the Jacksons' last album, and, right. and you know, so it's a fascinating interview to right. listen to.
So now we get to Michael. He's released Off the Wall. It's got two mega hits on it with what's the dance to get, you know, Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, and then and what's you know, Rock With You, you know, mega hits. Both of them number one.
I think so. I think yeah. they both hit number one.
Right. And then yeah. he had a couple more hits off of it. I mean, so I mean, it was a really huge album. I don't think it went. It was a number three album, so unfortunately it didn't go number one. I don't think it was the, I mean, it was a hit, but I don't think it was the hit that he was hoping for.
Right. Yep. And he was particularly disappointed the night of the American Music Awards. I don't know if the American Music Awards carry as much weight today as they did back, you know, some years ago, but, uh-huh. You know, it got a lot of awards for best R&B album and that kind right. of thing, but for pop and all, didn't get anything, and gotcha. I think he was really disappointed. You know, he thought, which it was an incredible album, and so he resolved that night. He was like, the next album I do,
right,
it's going to be a crossover,
right.
Success.
So on that album, he's got a song on there called Girlfriend, which we know is a, you know, Paul McCartney cover. Now, they had crossed paths in 1975. They met on the Queen Mary for the Venus and Mars wrap-up party, which, you know, this LP came out of the Captain or Professor Longhair right
yes.
there. I mean, that's, you know, was going on while they were all celebrating. And Paul had mentioned, hey, I've got the song Girlfriend, which I think would be, you know, great for you, which wouldn't be the first time. I mean, we all know that he thought, you know, Suicide would be great for, you know, for Frank Sinatra. Yeah. But I think he was a little bit more right this time, even though Paul did record it the year before. Michael still was interested in the song for,
yeah, I think Girlfriend circulates as a demo, as a piano
yeah,
demo,
as
a 74 on the piano tape. So
right.
it had been kicking
yeah.
around for about a year. So, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he had mentioned, and he had said in interviews where he had thought that Michael would be a good fit for this song. So, what are your thoughts on that song, Girlfriend? I mean, obviously you know both tracks very well,
right?
You know, what are your thoughts on the song?
I think it's fascinating how Michael and Quincy managed to change it to suit Michael's
right.
style a lot, mm-hmm. and I think a lot better for Michael. I mean,
right.
you know, they eliminated the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely focused more on the rhythm
right.
of it. And that was absolutely the perfect choice for him. You know, with
right.
Paul, it was more about sort of the melody of the bridge. And on that's just not, you know, that's not Michael's thing exactly. I mean,
right.
he could certainly sing melody. I mean, that's not it. But I just think it just suited his vocal abilities. I mean, he, as I mentioned in the book, he's one of the best percussive singers that
mm.
ever was. I mean, I think, and I mean, he just had that instinctual rhythm. So, you know, it's just fascinating when you listen to both songs back to back. They're just
right.
so different in a
yeah.
way. But
yeah.
I see, you know, why though Paul would have written that for Michael. I mean, because it is, you know, has more of a poppy feel
right.
To it, and it's catchy as hell. I mean, it really
is. I think
is.
It is. I think Michael really sings that song effortlessly. I mean, he just really flows with that song, whereas with, you know, I wouldn't say that, you know, Paul has a hard time singing it because I really like his falsetto voice.
Yeah.
But it's, I just think it sounds better with Michael singing it. Maybe I don't know if I like. I don't know if I prefer his version of the production version of his side. I still think I might like Paul's version a little bit better on that side of it. Mm-hmm. But I really enjoy Michael singing that song.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting because, of course, that was the first version of Girlfriend I heard, not Paul's. I mean, it was Michael's version. Yeah. So it's exactly, and it's really funny if you say that to like a first generation fan. I know some that I've said, well, you know, the Michael Jackson one was the first one I heard, and it's, you know.
Yeah. I prefer both of them. They're both equally strong and great in their own right. Mm-hmm.
They're different, yeah.
They're both different, but they both are both uniquely awesome, in my opinion. I mean, Michael's version rhythmically is a little bit more tight. You know, it's got a mm-hmm. more rhythm going on in it. And I think the production value in his with Quincy might be a smidge better than Paul's. But then again, you can't take away from Paul's version either, especially, you know, because that's also equally good. I mean, different, but both good at the same time, I think.
Right.
So, I agree. Yeah. I completely agree. Yep.
So now we flash forward to December of 1980, and there's a phone call in the McCartney household, and you know he picks it up and he hears this voice of who says it's Michael. He doesn't necessarily believe it's Michael, at first, but then he comes to believe that it's Michael, and one of the first things out of his mouth is, do you want to write some hits, and...
I think he actually called them on Christmas Day, too.
I know it was right around Christmas, or Christmas Day, Christmas Eve, mm-hmm. So that was, I'm sure, a really interesting conversation, because, to be honest with me, if you would have said that Michael and Paul McCartney were going to collaborate, I mean, I don't know how I would have felt about it. I'm not really sure if I saw the two collaborating at that time, maybe 1980, because, you got to remember, Ebony and Ivory's not out yet either, and he hasn't, gone into that, more of a new, poppy sound.
Well,
it's
kicking around at this time, but it's still not, it's not fully fleshed out yet as a duet or anything,
Right, exactly. So, Paul just says, well, why don't you come on out, in 81. So, there's video of him on the McCartney archive set where he's out there, riding horses with them, and a lot of pictures are taken. Matter of fact, you see Michael Jackson wearing a Wings Japan tour jacket, which
love that gotta love that.
I know.
Which I'm surprised Paul didn't burn all of those. I don't know why you wouldn't want any evidence of that bad time period. But
talk about a bad omen.
Yeah, exactly. And then it's also cool because you do see Michael Jackson wearing a Red Wings jacket, too, during recordings, too, just because I'm from Michigan, it's kind of cool to see him doing that, But, apparently that visit goes smashingly, they're getting along, Paul's daughters are, obviously in love with Michael Jackson because, he's the guy right now. I mean,
he's Michael Jackson.
Yeah, his star is on the rise.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, and people have asked me, particularly younger people, like, why would they work together? And as you just said, Tom, people back then probably wouldn't have immediately said, oh, yeah, why they would totally work together. I think it was a shrewd move because – remember when I said earlier about Michael being disappointed about Off the Wall that it wasn't a crossover hit?
Right.
Well, he said his next album, he determined, he's like, I am going to make this a big hit across the board. And one of the ways he wanted to do it was, hey, well, what better way to do it than to reach out? I mean, Paul was still a hit-making force at the time.
In the back of his mind, he's got to be thinking the same thing. Hey, I can reach a whole new audience as well.
Right, this young guy on the rise now, and I can, his career is growing, and I can maybe rejuvenate him a little bit in my career. So they're both thinking,
right.
Michael's coming up, and Paul's like, how do I get on that, how do I capture some of that magic myself?
Exactly. You've got age. I mean, different ages that they can reach, you know, different generations. I mean, you know, I think to both of them, it was sort of a, hey, this is good for both of us. And you know, I think it made a lot of sense. I think it was a shrewd move. And in his autobiography, Moonwalk, Michael also said he approached Paul also to kind of, you know, repay the favor for giving him Girlfriend,
right,
which I think that was part of it. But I think if he were to, you know, if he were being 100% honest, I think that was part of it too. It was
right.
it was a move to, you know, just like when Quincy Jones said when he and Michael were working on Beat It, you know, Quincy said, I want to have a rocker on here because we
right.
need to get the rock audience in here. Okay, let's get Eddie Van Halen to do a solo.
Right.
I mean, it was, you know, I hate to make it sound that calculated, but it was. I mean, it was to try and reach as many audiences as possible.
Maximize right. the audience and get all kind of genres represented on that album, of course.
Exactly, and it worked.
Yeah, true, very true. So, you know, they start working together. They move to MPL in London. The writing process now begins, and first thing they come up with is Say Say Say. You know, which, you know, becomes, as we all know now, the mega hit, one of the mega hits of the 80s. Let's talk about that song for a few minutes. You know, duets are, you know, are big at that time. There's a lot of great duets, you know, that, you know, in the early part of the 80s and throughout the 80s. There's a lot of memorable duets. You know, you got the, you know, the Crystal Gale, Eddie Rabbit, you got Streisand and Diamond, you got, you know, was it Lionel Richie and Diana Ross? I mean, the duets are just, you know, everywhere at that time. So, but the writing process on this, you know, it seemed to work well. I mean, Paul had said that, you know, Michael wasn't the great lyricist, but, you know, he was more of a singer, you know, the singer and dancer, but he came up with some good stuff. So, you know, Say Say Say, I mean, obviously is the massive hit. Kit, I mean, what were your thoughts on Say Say Say? I know we talked about it before when you were on, we talked about Pipes of Peace, but, you know, the great song, right?
I think it really holds up, you know, when the Pipes of Peace archive version came out a few years ago and they had the remix of it, and
right.
And I just thought, you know, it still has such a great R&B flavor to it. It's something that I wish Paul would have revisited more in his career. I thought his voice blended so well with Michael's, and,
yes.
And yeah, it really did. And I know he talked about, did sort of alter his voice on purpose. In an interview, I remember he said he didn't want to go really low, and
right.
You know, he said it sounded ridiculous. So he tried to match, you know, go a little more falsetto. And yeah, I mean, there were times where you almost couldn't tell their voices apart.
True.
Just amazing. And they just blended really well together, and I think they kind of pushed each other a little
mm-hmm.
bit. And it just worked. You know, love the harmonica, as I said,
yes.
Just had a real R&B groove to it. And yeah, I think, you know, Paul, they had to adjust to each other in terms of songwriting. Like, you know, there's the famous story when Michael wrote The Girl's Mine.
Right.
And he had that line, the doggone girl is mine.
Right, right. Yeah.
The doggone.
Exactly, right.
You know, and Michael was like, it's not about the word, it's the rhythm. And
right.
As I said, he was a rhythmic singer.
Mm.
You know, for him, it was the sound, it wasn't about the word. And so I think he and Paul had to kind of adjust to that, because, you know, Paul was all about, no, it's got to be the word. The word is,
right.
You know, it means something. And so I think their talents blended together very well on this, that they, parts of the song are rhythmic, you know. They
right.
just have, you know, the hoo, 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 and, you know, I mean, just things like, and even repeating Say, Say, Say.
Right.
But it just, the blending of their voices, the catchiness, it worked, and it became a massive hit. I mean, it was number one for, like, what, 8 weeks or something?
Six.
Yeah,
six.
I mean, it was, it seemed to be number one forever
right.
back in the day. I remember
yeah.
that.
It's got all the show, all the hooks. It's got all the hooks that it
yeah.
needed.
It does.
You know,
sing along?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and production value off the charts. with that song.
Right, yeah, and that's what was one of the things I was going to say is I think all three songs that we're going to talk about here, they were all produced masterfully. I think they, you know, all are great sounding records. You know, Andy, what were your thoughts on Say Say Say?
Just kind of echoing the point. Just I love the song. One of the things that I loved about it is hearing it as a young kid. Just at the end of it, just that, just look at my face and you see everything, right? And it just goes down. It just catches you. That sonic value there, and that production value, just grabs your attention as a listener.
Right.
And the whole thing of it, just it was just ear catching. And as growing up in the video age as I did, of course, it was really my exposure to it.
Right.
On VH1 and MTV was really how I first remember it. You know, I was a young child in the 80s, so that was really my first exposure to it before the record. Was the video age, so
right.
That's how I came to like it first. And of course, the video, and we'll go into that later. But the whole
right.
Mac and Jack and the Wonder Potion, all the story within the video is also awesome about the song. But in terms of the song, I mean, I love the song. I like the 2015 remix
right.
that we got, and we also got a vinyl edition of it on Record Store Day.
Record Store Day, where the vocals were switched.
Right, which I spun that earlier today to kind of get this kind of Mac and Jack pose for tonight.
Right.
But that was well done. And again, Paul proving that, you know, he can kind of come out with, you know, still with these archive releases and give us something fresh and new on all these with Say Say Say. It's a song that I don't get tired of. I could play it tonight, I could play it in 2 months, and it's still fresh to my ears, you know, 20-some-odd years later.
Right. And, you know, they did this, so they did the first sessions in 81, and I think this is really a sign of McCartney trusting Jackson, because then he let Jackson take it to L.A. for him to have his sessions men now work on that song as well, without McCartney's involvement, you know, which I think shows a lot of, you know, trust in Michael to let him, you know, just take the song, which, you know, we all know became this, you know, massive hit, you know. So now we got, you know, Paul or Michael's people working on the song. So now that's where the harmonica comes in, that excellent harmonica solo. But what are you gonna say?
I actually had a quick question, just maybe Kit can clarify. So say is the beginning of the whole collaboration. It's not The Girl Is Mine.
Oh no, The Girl Is Mine is the first one. Yeah.
Say is the first song written. The Girl Is Mine. Right.
The Girl Is Mine was written mainly by Michael.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, and then Say and The Man were written at about the same time, but the first ones together.
Together, right. Okay. Yeah. I just wasn't sure.
It's funny because The Girl Is Mine is the last one worked on with the two, but the first one released.
The first one to come out. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the lead off.
Confusing.
Yeah, it was the lead off single for Thriller.
Yeah.
And that, you know, went to number two. So now obviously, you know, want to do some hits together. And I mean, that it's starting to materialize now. So we got a number two, you know. So what's coming up? You know, a few months later now we've got, you know, Say, which, also, I was talking with Kit before he joined us, Andy. It's like, this is another Beatles connection here with Michael Jackson. Say was Michael's seventh top 10 hit in 1983, surpassing the Beatles and Elvis with six hits in 1 year. So Jackson now passed the Beatles again in another category.
By 83, you know, sure. Well, because
of 83 was just a massive year for Michael.
Riding off the backtrack, you know, of Thriller, and just take Say and just put another feather in his cap with that.
Yeah, sure.
Exactly.
Sure did. And then, you know, you also mentioned that that the end of Say, which I don't know, but you realize that the mix of the video is different than the you know, because you get that extra You Never Ever Worry bit there at the end of the video,
right?
Whereas on the track on the album, you don't get that extra.
No, they brought it back in on the video again towards
right,
the end.
Exactly, which I think that's a much better version. I love them doing that play out there at the end.
That's the best. That's
rather
the best.
Than it just ending with the music,
no.
You know, on the album.
Yeah, well, it's nice hearing that again, because it takes the video out nicely. Because it's really, you see the two of them really exchanging back and forth on that point again. Which they did, I mean, okay, it might be a little bit repetitive, but it's just so good, you know, it was worth repeating. It really was.
Right.
Yeah.
There's some great lyrics in there, absolutely.
Good point.
Yeah. Let's move on to The Man, which is another song down. Now, this one was co-written by Jackson and McCartney, just like Say was.
Right. Just as good, in my opinion.
Okay.
And I'm glad you said that, because this song has been really put down in recent years.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm not saying it would have been as massive a hit as Say was,
right. But
their harmonies on it are solid. I mean, really solid. And it's catchy in its own way. It's really kind of a pretty melody. And I don't know why this song has gotten so trashed over time. I mean, I don't know why.
I think about both songs this way. I think The Man has much more of a McCartney production style.
Yeah.
Say has more of a Quincy Jones, Michael Jackson style. Think about The Man. It opens up with that searing guitar lick, which is McCartney through and through. And if you know McCartney's guitar playing,
right. That
is him through and through opening up. It's got the little orchestrations going all through it, you know. So that's much more of a McCartney classical trained background production style. And maybe that's why he's not so revered. When you're putting a Michael Jackson duet spin on a McCartney Aladdin production style, it may not have just resonated as well with audiences. Not as much more as obviously Say and the kind of song that was. But I mean, it's still for me, it's just as good. I mean, I think The Man is a tremendous song. It's a shame that we didn't get a video for it. A missed opportunity. But The Man, I probably play The Man as much as I do Say.
One of the things I really thought was cool on Michael's behalf was that he insisted that Linda partake in the vocals, which, you know, you can hear her throughout, and she actually does share some, you know, lead vocals with Michael, I think, with when he sings "This is the Man," and they're going, and he thought "This is the way it's supposed to be" or whatever, and you hear, you know, it's Linda and Jackson doing that bit, which is really nice. But The Man started out as just a demo by Paul. He suggested the song, and it was written, because not a lot is written about this song. You know, there's not a lot of information,
No.
You know, especially from Pipes of Peace. You know, not a lot is, you know, in the Luca Brasi book either on this, because it just wasn't a lot of information.
But considering this is co-written by two of the most famous people on earth, and we have little to scant written about it, is really a good travesty. It really is.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Exactly. So, you know, it's a McCartney song at first, but Paul presents the song, and, you know, Michael helps with some of the, you know, words on, so they rewrite it. He helps with that, and, you know, and there you go. Now, both of these songs are put on the shelf then after that, you know, which is really surprising, because, you know, we know he's working on Tug of War, and I'm sure he's already got, you know, a long list of songs that are going to be, you know, for Tug of War, and then plus with all these other leftover songs. So I'm kind of still surprised that, you know, he doesn't finish these songs, but, I mean, does he need them at this point in time? You know, this is 81. You know, he hasn't released anything since 80. You know, we don't get anything from him until 82. It's kind of surprised that they just don't finish it and maybe release it as a single.
And get done, you know, with it. And be done with it. And as it turns out, these songs don't come out till October of 83, nearly the end of 84. So really held on to them for quite a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really weird. The thought process on that, you know, why just give up on them? I don't know if maybe because they're of commitments and other, you know, on both ends, you know, maybe different commitments or whatnot. But
Kit, when did Thriller come out? What month of 82?
82.
But what? When in 82 exactly? Do you know?
It was like November.
I'm gonna look
somewhere
that up right now.
Yeah, it was like November, December, something like that.
You know, you wonder what goes into the ideas of the marketing and this stuff. Like, they're working all throughout 81. Paul's doing, you know, sessions for Tug of War. He's doing the stuff with Michael Jackson. Michael's doing Thriller. But then again, on top of this, Paul really spends a lot of 83 doing Broad Street, too. And then, at the end of 83, just dumps this stuff off. So it's curious as to why he didn't. Thriller's out in 82. Beginning of 83, you'd think, maximize it and get it all out there, but it ends up coming out way after the fact, really.
Yeah, so,
yeah.
So Thriller's released November of 82.
So yeah. nearly 83 itself, almost, too.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And you're looking at it's November 30th, so you're looking almost December now.
Right,
you know,
right.
So,
yeah. I'm willing to bet most of 1983 is probably, the charts are dominated by Thriller, obviously.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, 83 in a nutshell is Thriller, and really, and back at the end of the year with Say, Say, Say.
Right.
Yeah.
And, yeah. I was going to mention that too. For the man, I mean, that guitar playing by McCartney throughout the song is really good.
Tremendous.
You know, because he is when it comes to electric guitar, I think he is kind of at times considered an underrated guitar player. I mean, he's no David Gilmour, but he's still very capable of a lead guitarist.
For sure. Yeah, and I think it's and it's a great contrast. I mean, you have the sort of fuzzy, lead guitar, and then you get these beautiful, harmonies to go with it. I mean, I like that contrast between rock and I don't know, folk is the word I'm looking for, but just that hard and soft kind of sound.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an overlooked song. I think it's been unfairly kind of, trashed over the years, because
I think it has a very good cinematic quality too. If you listen to the beginning of The Man, it's got those strings, right? It's almost like it could be in a movie. Again, it grabs your attention right away. It's like, ooh, what's going on with this
suspense.
Song? Yeah, builds the suspense. You hear these strings, and all of a sudden, boom, right into a searing guitar from McCartney.
Yeah,
it's tremendous. It really is.
Yeah. All right, so let's jump then to The Girl Is Mine. Here's another song that is a duet by the two. It's a song only written by Michael Jackson. And it's kind of, this is Quincy Jones kind of suggesting why don't you write a song about two guys fighting over a girl. You know, which he does. But he's also, he wrote the song while hanging out with McCartney. So it's also weird that this wasn't a co-write either, because they're hanging out together at the same time, But like you said, it's got Michael written all over, especially, like the whole, doggone girl is mine bit. Anyway, I hear that and it's like, that's so Michael.
It is. And, there's really a kind of a playful quality about it. I mean, particularly toward the end when they have that little dialogue. And
you can tell they're having fun doing it.
Exactly. I mean, people like to make fun of it and everything. And, but I think, the whole thing is just they're it's a wink. I mean, they're really just having fun with it. And I can't tell you how many people have said to me, how they don't like the song, they can't believe it was a hit. I think, I don't like it as well as Say, 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 I'll say that. But it did fit in with the sound of the time. I mean, if you look at the songs that were popular in 82, I mean, it was a lot of adult contemporary stuff.
Yes,
so it did fit in. Lionel Richie was big, and all that. So it did.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. So it did fit in with that sound. I mean, I think it was, and it was a way, I mean, again, it was to build anticipation for Thriller, and to have, two big stars come together on this one single, pre-Say, Say, Say, of course.
Right.
But, it was a big deal. I mean, I remember when it came out. I mean, you had Paul McCartney and Michael Jackson. I mean, that was like a... I mean, that was really, really a big deal. And, and Quincy Jones did a great... I mean, I'm a huge fan of Quincy Jones as a producer. I think he's, other than George Martin, second to none. And it's a, just a beautiful job. And I think Paul's voice Paul's voice is strong on this, too.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. I think, both of their voices on all three of these songs are excellent. As you said, Kit, earlier, I mean, their voices blended very well together, and this is no exception. I mean, this is, no doubt one of, I think, Paul's, and Michael's, I mean, great vocal talents are on hold here. I mean, it's really an amazing effort between the two of them. And another thing that I was really surprised about that I think you wrote in your book was is that, members of Toto helped record the song. I did not know that.
That's something I really learned as I was writing that book. Toto played a huge part on the Thriller album. Huge. I mean, they were basically the backing band. They were known themselves at that time. I mean, they had had, you know, Hold the Line and some right. other hits. But they were also, like, the top studio band, and Quincy Jones was a huge fan of theirs.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I can't remember, 1982 was the same year, and I have to check and see when it came out, if it was before Thriller or after Thriller, is the year they had their massive album Toto 4 with Rosanna and Africa. Exactly. That's also 82. Exactly. So Toto was also riding sky high commercially at this time as well.
Exactly, you know, but yeah, I mean, this is slightly off topic, but I learned that, you know, like Steve Lukather did all the guitar parts on Beat It except for Eddie Van Halen's solo. Yeah. I mean, you know, it was just amazing learning things like that. So absolutely, they were the backing band on The Girl's Mind, did a wonderful job.
Yeah, going back course. With the...
Yeah, Total 4 is released in April of 82.
Okay, so before.
Same time as Tug of War, actually. Wow.
Right.
Interesting. Yeah. So one of the things, going back to the production value, just on The Girl Is Mine, an observation I've always held with that is, it almost sounded like Quincy was channeling a little 10cc in that song a little bit. If you hear, like, when it gets to the part, you know, Take You Anywhere, you hear those real big echoes. That's like 10cc, Eric Stewart. A lot of that same stuff that you're hearing from 10cc, but you're also hearing on Paul's Take It Away, which has Eric Stewart on it also. So a lot of the same production qualities crossing over in a lot of this music around the same time, really.
Yes, Billy Joel uses that too on one of his ballads as well. You know, that big echo that you hear from you know, Take It Away, and then, you know, I'm Not in Love as well. I mean, I really love that sound. It's a really cool, you know, studio trick that, you know, to get that big sound like that out there.
Very,
really
very prevalent
it.
On The Girl Is Mine, and done very well by Quincy, of course.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So, you know, we talked a minute about, you know, Say video, but the big surprise was that we didn't get a video for The Girl Is Mine, which is really odd because, you know, MTV is becoming this big, I mean, I remember MTV in 82 and I was on the floor, my eyes were glued to that channel. Every time I had an opportunity to watch MTV, I just was a massive fan. And then learning that there was, you know, no video for this, and it still became a number two hit, I think just proves how good that song was. Because, you know, I really think, you know, during during that hot period, I think there was a lot of songs that weren't really that good, but they become hits because there might have been pretty good videos.
Well, and by 82, still not every artist made videos. You know, I think there was still some resistance. I'm not saying, you know, Paul and Michael were resistant, but I think there was still, and maybe record companies weren't willing.
Well, there are a lot of politics involved in that, getting you know, artists' videos on MTV. It's really, really fascinating. You know,
exactly. Well, remember, Michael and other African American artists were having a hard time getting played on MTV, and it wasn't until the head of CBS Epic, you know, when he presented Billie Jean, I think it was, to MTV, and they said, gosh, this is a great video, it's too bad we can't play it, and the president said, fine, I'm pulling all my other videos off, and at that time, that was a big threat, because, as I said, not every artist was making videos, so they would lose a lot, and so they said, okay, and then, of course, the ironic thing is Michael ends up, he becomes MTV, practically,
exactly.
I mean, he was MTV.
Yeah, listen, when Say, it seemed like Say was getting played every half hour on MTV. I mean, it was everywhere. And another interesting fact about that video is it was filmed on location of what would eventually become Neverland Ranch.
Yes, it was. And, you know, and it had, it also had, I found out later, you have to look carefully, Harry Dean Stanton made a cameo in it.
Yes.
Art Carney made a cameo. you know, and it was just very well done. Now, the director, Bob Giraldi, and I mentioned you guys before we were on the air, my weird connection, my dad actually worked with him on a commercial years ago. And they didn't talk about this video, unfortunately.
Right.
But Bob Giraldi said in an interview that Paul is understandably really insecure about those dance numbers with Michael.
Really?
I mean, yeah, oh yeah. I mean, can you imagine saying, now you're going to dance with Michael Jackson? I mean, yeah. You know, he was really insecure. But, you know, and they really had to do some convincing and all. And but he said they were both great to work with. And I thought that was, and you were mentioning it earlier, Andy, a great video. It had a storyline.
Yes.
It was well shot. You know, it was really one of the best videos of the 80s.
They took advantage of everything that what made videos great. You know,
exactly.
Like I said, the storyline was there. I mean, you could follow it. You know, I mean, you watch it and you knew what was going on. I mean, you didn't have to be told.
Yeah,
I mean, everything was pointed out for
you. I think one of the McCartney kids or one of the kids that chasing the cart too in the video, I think. Remember back in the day, VH1, talking about music video, they used to have a show called Pop-Up Video where they'd show you little facts.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yes.
Sure.
And I remember watching this and during one of those years of the McCartney weeks when he was promoting, I think, Flaming Pie, and Pop-Up Video came on and they showed Say, 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 and they had all the facts. And I think that one of the children chasing after the wagon is one of the McCartney kids. I forget which one, but I think it was one of them.
That would make sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. I mean, if you were to see it, you probably would have known which one it was because all three of them were, I mean, you could pretty much distinct who was who at that time.
Yeah, it could have been Stella or Mary, I'm not sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And before we started recording, Kit, you and I were both talking about The Man and, you know, reasons, you know, you and I think we found different answers to why, during our research, why that song wasn't released as a single. So
yeah.
Why don't you start off?
Well, it was supposed to be the third single off that album, I believe.
Pipes of Peace.
The Pipes of Peace, that's right. And it was the story was it was supposed to be backed by a song called Blackpool. Now,
right.
The Man supposedly was then removed from consideration for a single at the request of Michael Jackson's label because they felt it would conflict with too many of the, you know, they were putting out Thriller single after Thriller single, and
right.
I guess they felt it would be flooding the marketplace too much.
Right.
And Blackpool, this is a single that has been, or a song that's been kind of mysterious. You know, some people thought it was a collaboration with Paul and Michael. Other, I've read it was actually a song, and we were talking about this before we went on, that it was sort of a demo Paul was working on, and it was just going to be him just sort of, you know, lengthening the demo, and then that was going to be the B-side, and then you heard a different story.
Yeah, you know, if you check out Luca Prati's book, I mean, his version of that take is that, you know, come that time, Paul is busted for the marijuana in Barbados. So this was about the same time that the thoughts about releasing that as a single was taking place, and he did not want to get Michael Jackson's name involved in that whole, you know, drug bust, you know, situation. You know, so I mean, I think your research sounds a little bit more realistic. you know, than this one, but you know, you never know.
Who knows?
We unfortunately we both weren't there at either situation, so
we'll never know.
Yeah.
And you would think if it was true, you would think when the archive edition came out in 2015, if this was true, it would have came out on that at that time.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
But then again, look, we got like It's Not On, so who knows?
Right. Which I think is an incredible track, but that's for another show.
Oh,
yeah. But you know, during this whole time, to keep going and get to the real of the meat and potatoes of the conversation here. During this whole time, is you know, Paul is starting to slip Michael some advice. You know, hey, you know. You know, I've gotten into this music publishing thing. It's made me a lot of money. Maybe you should, you know, consider, you know, doing the same thing. And, you know, and then we get, you know, Michael teasing, you know, Paul about, you know, buying his music. So, yeah, I mean, this whole, you know, Michael buying the Northern Song issue. I mean, it's really, yeah. I don't know if it's complicated. I don't know, you know, how you would describe it, Kit. But you know, why don't you start us off on that?
Complicated is a good word. that's a very good word. And let me also just start off by saying, and I'm glad you're giving me an opportunity because to talk about this, because I cannot tell you how many times I've been told in person or I've read it online that Michael stole the songs from Paul. He did not steal anything. You know, it was a business deal.
Right.
And, you know, and it was a complicated one. So while Paul and Michael were working together, of course, as you mentioned, Michael asked Paul for advice on investments. And so Paul told him about, you know, how he was investing in music publishing, showed him his portfolio, and Michael was, of course, very impressed. You know, showed him a binder of all the songs he owned and everything. And Michael actually wrote in his autobiography, he said, Paul and I both learned the hard way about business and the importance of publishing and royalties and the dignity of songwriting. So that's when Michael said, I'm going to buy your songs one day. And Paul laughed and said, oh, how funny. Now, this would probably be a whole other show, so I'm not going to go into the whole story. But essentially, you know, this goes back to the contract the Beatles signed. You know, when they first signed their deal. And essentially, they didn't really own the publishing rights to their songs. It was this Northern Songs. Corporation, which was sold to ATV. Sir Lou Gray, that's right, in 69, I believe. So we fast forward to 1985 when ATV is put up for sale. So Michael was interested in buying the catalog. I mean, after all,
4,000 songs, including Northern Songs. I mean, that's a nice little, you know, investment.
That's a nice little investment indeed. You know, so from the research I did, Michael's attorney, John Branca, who incidentally is still the executor of the estate. He asked John Branca to start putting out feelers, you know, about buying it. So, and he said, contact Yoko and Paul to determine whether they were interested in putting in a bid. So, he first contacted Yoko. And at the time, by the way, Yoko was friends with Michael. She and Sean. Sean was in the film Moonwalker. Anyway, and Yoko said no, she was not interested in putting in a bid, and said that no, if we had bought it, we'd have to deal with Paul. It would be a whole event of whole thing. That's a quote I found. And so then, you know, she's like, why are you asking? And so when John Branca told her, she said, oh, that would be wonderful in the hands of Michael rather than some big corporation. Okay, so that was that. He then contacted Paul and through John Eastman, who was his attorney at the time, asked him, and he said that Paul had no interest in paying the price that was being asked. One reason is it turns out that this catalog consisted of not only Beatles songs, but they were copyrights to thousands of other compositions, a sound effects library, and even some real estate. Like, there was a bunch of stuff. So after consulting, you know, with both parties, John Branca then first offered $30 million, and then it was bumped up to $40 million. And then ultimately, Michael bought it for $47.5 million.
Right.
So that's, you know, that's the whole thing. You know, Michael was thrilled when he ended up getting it. And Paul, not so much. But I just want to point that out. Was it the nicest thing to do on a friendship level? Probably not.
Yeah.
But it was business. And he didn't steal it. It was, you know, it was all business.
And he had a chance to match. And he didn't want, and he chose
not to. Exactly.
Yeah. I mean,
he had every chance.
Yeah, he probably could have kept outbidding too. I mean, I think at that point in time, in 84, 85, I think McCartney was considered the richest music act out there, even that early. You know, so I would be willing to bet that he could have afforded this all by himself. I don't really think he needed to go to Yoko to see if she wanted to. However, it is a nice gesture on his part to consider, you know, going, hey, Yoko, let's team up on this and let's, you know, get mine and John's music back.
Yeah.
Which is how I think I would have approached it, well, you know, saying, hey, it's our music,
right,
not just mine.
Right. And apparently she had said something like, well, we can do better, or we'll wait out, or something like that. She thought that they could get a better price or something like that. I don't know if that's true, kid, or not. It's what I had read over the years.
Yeah, I've heard that, too. Right. I mean, bargain down the Beatles catalog? I mean, it's not going to happen.
No.
I mean, this deal makes them, as close to billionaires as you're going to get. I would assume. I don't think Paul was a billionaire just yet at that point in time, but I mean, that deal would have set him up.
To echo on what Kit was saying, you know, I'm much more of a Beatles fan than a Michael Jackson fan. I am a Michael Jackson fan of moderate, but I mean, to somebody saying that he stole it is just not, it's just not true, and it's not fair. They had every chance, the Beatles and the estates had every chance to get it back.
That's right.
And they did not act, and it is what it is.
Yep, exactly. That's it.
Yes. Yeah, so you mentioned John Branca, his manager and entertainment lawyer at the time, and he really did his work on this. I mean, he really, you know, Michael said, I want you to go get him, and he got him. And, you know, he really, because of him, you know, getting that due diligence done early, you know, he was able to, you know, force the seller's hand because they were ready to go. Here's the money. You know, we've got all this work done. We can do this quicker than anybody else, and, you know, thanks to him. You know, it's Michael's. It became Michael's.
Exactly, and of course, was a very sound investment.
Right.
Kid, when did the deal actually finally go through?
I got August 10th of 1985.
Yep, it was. Yeah, it was about that time because he then gave an interview. Michael did on September 22nd, 1985. You know, talking about how thrilled he was to be on it. You know. Bought the catalog, so
right.
Wow. It's about that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like as you say, you know, Paul is not really, you know, let's say not that happy about the outcome, you know, and you know the friendship, I you know, you can safely say has become torn because of that. You know, they do end up in pictures together. They do meet up from time to time, but you know, the chance of them ever working together is at that point is probably shot. You know, you'll never, you know, see them working together. You know, what, 10 years later, I think it was, Paul now tries to get a raise from him. You know, it's like, hey, my music is making you a lot of money. Why don't you, you know, give me, you know, a little bit back, you know? And he never gets a response from Michael. And when he does get a response, it's like, hey, it's just business. You know?
Yeah. Well, in the late 80s, you know, Paul was, of course, I mean, because it was fresh off the purchase,
right.
You know, could barely control his bitterness at what happened, and was bitter particularly at having to basically have to ask permission to perform his own song at his concerts. And he said in an interview with McLean's in 89, Michael apparently has drawn up a list of songs that he thinks could be used in commercials and songs that he doesn't think ought to be. So, I mean, he sits there in judgment. So he said that. Then fast forward to 2001, where he did an interview with Howard Stern, and he talked about what you were just mentioning about, you know, doesn't he deserve a raise? And then he then said, but this is weird. He says, that he comments that even if the rumors, this was in 2001, there were rumors that Michael was thinking of selling the catalog, that he says he couldn't afford to buy them back. He said, the trouble is I wrote those songs for nothing and buying them back at these phenomenal sums, I just can't do it.
Right.
Get out of here.
I agree.
I think if you buy this, even if you pay the $100,000, I mean, you're getting your money back almost automatically.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as you buy them, I would imagine. I mean, how many different radio stations are playing Beatles songs on a daily basis?
Right.
you know, worldwide.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly. I mean,
you know, you got to pay whoever owns that music. You got to, I mean, if you want to cover them live, you got to pay, right?
Exactly. And if I mean,
If you want to record it one lot in a studio, you got to pay them, correct?
Yeah, you know, and it stinks. I mean, yes, you signed that contract in the 60s, it stinks to have to think about, you know, paying for songs that you wrote and everything. I mean, but it is business. I mean, can you do? It is just, you said, Andy, it is what it is.
And then if you want to use, say, a song in a commercial, you got to pay them, right?
Right, absolutely. Big bucks.
Right, which is what Nike ended up doing in 1987. Now, beforehand, I was reading that if somebody wanted to use a Beatles song in a commercial, they re-recorded it. So it was never the actual original recording of a Beatles track. They were always re-recorded. Not the case here with Nike. They actually did use the song Revolution. You know, and I think that also, in a way, ticked off the, Paul, George, and Ringo in a way, because Paul has always told the story as, hey, we had plenty of opportunities to give our music out to commercials. And he said he's talking like the big ones like Coke and stuff like that. But he had always felt like giving the song to a commercial kind of cheapened the song.
Cheapens it.
This was a huge deal back in the day. I mean, I remember that. And in fact, I don't think that commercial aired very long because it was so controversial. And now Yoko supposedly okayed it. I mean, she was the one who really, you know, put the stamp of approval on it. And
You Never Give Me Your Money, the Doggett book. Talks about how, you know, it was Yoko's doing on how she felt it would be cool for a new generation to hear, you know, a John song in this way.
Yeah, and oh boy, I mean, it really backfired. And it's just interesting today, you know, you hear original recordings of not only Beatles songs, but others all the time, and nobody seems to think anything of it now.
And Paul has given, I mean, I've heard Great Day in a Chase Bank commercial.
Yeah.
Or, you know, so he's given out his songs to commercials now, here in the future. Whereas, you know, with the Beatles song, I don't know if his thought process is a little different on that or not. I don't know.
Yeah.
Because it is the Beatles, you know, it's a whole nother thing. You know?
That's right. Yeah. Yep. That's true.
Or, you know, maybe the school of thought is, hey, look, everybody else is making money off your songs. Why don't you make some money off your own for a change too? And just allow, you know,
yeah.
That could be it, too.
I bet. Right. That's true.
It's really interesting when money is involved in this stuff. And it's, it can really, you know, either ruin a relationship or create relationships. You know,
And we don't, you know, as we mentioned before we went on the air, is that, you know, we don't, you know, there was some kind of agreement made with Paul and Sony. And we don't really know what's happened since now in the years preceding Michael Jackson's death. But, you know... we're not going to hear about it anytime soon.
Oh, probably not. We'll probably never hear about it.
Yeah. No, we will. Somebody will. Somebody will one day.
Right, Plus, that's just American rights, too, I believe, that for that Sony
deal. Yeah, I think you're right.
It's only American rights, so it doesn't include, you know, rights in the UK.
No.
So, but either way, you know, I'm sure, you know, he's getting another chunk of change. He's getting another check to cash every month, so.
Yeah.
But anyway, this is a really cool discussion, and I really appreciate you, Kit, coming on and discussing this. We had a lot of fun. Is there anything else you wanted to bring up about the whole topic?
Well, just that it was interesting that when Michael passed, when Paul gave interviews after that there seemed to be kind of... You know, I think he was ready to sort of let bygones be bygones.
Yeah.
And, you know, he seems to have let go of a lot of the bitterness and everything, and which was great to see.
Right.
There were a lot of rumors going around at the time that Michael had put in his will that, you know, he was going to give all the songs back to Paul. Wasn't true. But it was really nice to see. And of course, when Paul came out with the Pipes of Peace archive, It was great to hear him talking about working with Michael. Yes. and just sort of saying, you know, I'm choosing to remember the good times we had working in the studio together, writing the songs. So it was really nice to kind of see it come full circle and to finally hear him say, okay, I'm just going to, you know, put our differences aside.
As John Lennon always says, time wounds all heals, you know. So.
Right. That's right. You got it.
So to put the cap on this discussion, you know, where do you rate this collaboration in – because before this, I forgot to mention, ask you this earlier, before this, Michael didn't do a lot of duets, did he not?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I mean, he did – some, I mean, there was a duet on Off the Wall, but it was with Patty Austin, who was wonderful. I love Patty Austin, but not like a big star. I mean, this was a very significant collaboration in Michael's career. I mean, I think it really, you know, was crucial in getting him to, I mean, it wasn't the only factor, but it was a factor, big factor in helping him become the, you know, superstar that he became.
Right. I think that's accurate. I mean, needless to say, I mean, you know, hey, let's make some hits. It worked. They had a number two, they had a number one, and they had another potential single that unfortunately didn't become a single. But I'd have to say that this partnership was a success.
It sure was. And the songs are still, particularly Say, still playing today.
Yeah, no, I still hear it on radio stations, especially the ones that play a lot of 80s music, you know, 70s and 80s, they still play, you know, that song is still in rotation today. You know, it's such a great song.
Timeless, very, very timeless.
Yeah, it really is.
It hasn't aged at all.
Yeah. So, Kit, once again, we thank you very much for coming on and talking about this topic. I mean, I've learned a lot, you know, especially from your book and just, you know, digging into this whole situation. And I thought it was really cool to have, because I don't think this relationship gets talked about a lot. So, and plus, you know, like I said earlier, I thought you were the perfect, you know, fit for this. But what you got coming up? You know, what do you want to plug? And, you know, what are you doing in the future?
Well, of course, you can always find me on Facebook at Kit O'Toole's Keynotes. You can find me on Twitter at Kit O'Toole. Of course, I host this other show, co-host this other show you may have heard of, called Talk More Talk, Soul Beatles Videocast. We'll be doing our next show, March 2nd?
2nd or 3rd, yeah.
Yeah. Go to our Facebook page and sign up for that. You'll then get all the notices for our next episodes. My columns will be returning soon. I've been doing a lot of shows lately, like this one. So now I'm going to be getting back to writing. So just
Great.
Finally getting back to that. So just check out my Facebook page, and on I always post whenever a new episode is up. I'll be on a new episode of Tomorrow Never Knows. That's coming up soon, and I think that's everything. So
another nickname is the Queen of Guest Spotting on podcasts.
I mean, you are just,
it's like a never ending. It seems like every time we're doing a Talk More Talk show, you're promoting a guest spot on another show.
Exactly. No, I enjoy it. It's a lot of fun. And thank you for inviting me on, Eric. First of all, I just always love being on, but with you. But also, you know, thanks for letting me talk about this, because I think this is a topic that's often misunderstood you know, not talked about enough. So thanks for having me on.
Yeah, you got it. You're welcome. And I'm really looking forward to seeing you in March at the Fest for Beatles fans. You know, Andy, but go ahead, Andy.
I got one little thing. We're going to do like news at the end. We usually do news at the front, but I just saw something on my phone here that is relevant to our podcast. Paul McCartney himself was spotted in downtown Metuchen, New Jersey, snapping photos this afternoon about 35 minutes away from me right here in New Jersey today.
No way.
Wow.
Yep, it just came across
And you didn't run to go find him?
We started doing recording. Paul McCartney snaps photos in New Jersey downtown, and downtown Metuchen, which is about 30 minutes away from me. And there's photos of him walking around the street today. So here he is right in the Gold Garden State.
Wow. Wow. Too bad it's not coming next month.
I know. The article said, well, what the guy asked him, what are you doing here? And it says, according to the article, he's with Nancy's daughter, or let me just give me a sec here. The explanation is simple. His wife, Nancy Chevelle, is an Edison native and a J.P. Stevens graduate, and he was taking pictures of her home area. So that's why he was in the area today.
Gotcha. Well, now that we're also talking with you, Andy, I also wanted to discuss with you your reading. You got the new Ted Montgomery book, the Paul McCartney catalog. You're reading that now, and just give us a little tidbit of your thoughts on that book.
Yeah, well, I did finally. I got Ted's book a lot sooner than you did. Did you get it yet?
Yeah. No, I still haven't gotten it.
Yeah, I'm about halfway done with Ted's book, the Paul McCartney catalog, which we had Ted on about a month ago. It's in about 200 some odd pages, which I know a lot of us all felt was kind of on the slim side for a 50-year discography, but it's been a very pleasant read so far. It's concise. Ted kind of covers the discography, he covers the studio albums, the live stuff, the experimental stuff, and he covers every song, and he gives it's a very opinionated piece. He tells you what he likes and what he doesn't like, which is refreshing for a change. It's not just somebody saying they love everything, which is nice.
Right.
And I'm halfway done with it, and I'm going to be publishing a little review of my take on it on our two legs pages and stuff as soon as I'm done with it in another day or two. But a very nice read, and again, something kind of driving home a point, which has kind of been very near and dear to me, is that we're discussing Paul McCartney in context in the present day about his solo career, and something that really has not been done really since gotten really big in the last 10 years or so, but like Ted's works and other people we've had on here, like Luca you referenced today.
Yeah, and John Blaney too.
And John Blaney. Ted joins another legion of authors that's kind of maximizing and bringing attention to Paul's own career, which is 50 years long and really deserves the attention it needs to. I did feel initially 200 pages was kind of short, but Ted has done a nice job for, so far from what I've read, and I'm sure you'll agree when you get it. But I will have a nice little review of the book in a couple of days on our page.
And speaking of John Blaney, he's got this four volume set where he talks about all of Paul's stuff or releases and decade by decade. So he's got 70s, 80s, 90s, and the first 2000s. I did reach out to him a few months ago and asked him if he was going to do the 2010s, and he was nice enough to get back and said, well, he started, but he lost interest in it because, I mean, a lot of it was just a lot of archive stuff.
Yeah.
He said there just wasn't enough new material to really, want to get into it.
Yeah. So you must have a different set of the Blaney. The Blaney must have released the decades separately.
Yeah.
When I got that book, I have all the decades as one book.
Yeah, see, this is how I got it. Like, it's just,
it's all
80s.
Yeah, it's all one book.
Right.
So when I got it around circa 2000, 2001. Like, I think it ends right around Driving Rain, I think, Blaney's book ends.
Right.
So, again, it's a great book, and Ted did a good job, and happy to have
him. Glad to hear that.
And when you get it, you can read it, too.
Yeah, I can't wait. It's a bit frustrating, but I can't wait. Anyways, but once again, you can all find us on Podbean. We're on iTunes. We're on iHeartRadio. We got our YouTube channel. So we're also a video cast, as you can tell right now. Same as Talk More Talk. We're also on Instagram and Twitter at Two Legs Podcast. You can find us on Facebook at Two Legs Podcast. As I said in the last couple of episodes, for some reason, our Facebook page got unpublished for one reason or the other. No point in getting into it now, but a new Facebook page is created. So if you want to, head over to Two Legs on Facebook and check that out, please do. And, Andy, anything else you want to cover before we sign off?
No, you got it all covered. We're looking forward to another few weeks of shows, and then before you know it, we'll all be at the fest.
Absolutely, absolutely. A little side note, I've been Chip Manninger reached out to me about a possible appearance discussing the Eight Arms to Hold You or Me or whatever it's called book, and looking forward to
my Bible.
There it is.
It's my Bible.
Great pluck. I have it.
Yeah. So looking forward to that. And as always, everybody, have a great day and a beautiful night. So long.
Listening to Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast, hosted by Tom Hunyadi and Andy Nichols, with musical contributions by Dylan.